Those were the dulcet sounds of the Warthog. Good afternoon. Thanks for tuning in to Animal Voices here on Co-op Radio 102.7 FM. My name is John Pranger, and with me in the studio is Carl Loskin. Hello, Carl.
Good day to you.
We've got three guests today. Marius Gripachaiko will be talking to us about organic agriculture and the need for subsidies to bring organic production onto a level playing field with heavily subsidized chemical agriculture. We also have Robert McCandles with us to give us his take on the implementation of Codex Alimentarius and what that will mean to Canadians. And in the last segment of the show, we have activist Ashley Fruno on to talk to us about various things. Now, Albert Schweitzer, as I mentioned last week, Carl, was about to admit into the lofty chambers of philosophy all four-legged and winged creatures when death interrupted his long life entirely dedicated to showing the meaning of humanity to his fellow men. And there's a far cry between such men and the confraternity of animal experimenters who, on the one hand, compare the animal's physiological, nervous, and psychological reaction to that of the human being, but on the other hand, claim that they can do with them whatever they please because animals don't suffer. What could be more ridiculous, more hypocritical, than to say animals don't reason or feel or suffer and then to use them for experiments designed to explain human behavior? It seems to me highly significant that for all their continual contact with animals, those individuals don't seem to notice that all animals are endowed with an exquisite sensitivity and with a kind of intelligence that, although in many respects different from that of humans, is not necessarily inferior to ours. Should we entrust our health to such men and women who think this way? Voltaire wrote in his Philosophical Dictionary, "To say that the animals are machines without knowledge and sentiment, and that they always do everything in the same way, without learning and perfecting anything, is a sign of stupidity. The bird which builds its nest in a half circle against a wall, in a quarter circle in a corner, and a full circle on a treetop, does this bird do everything in the same way? And when you want to teach a melody to a canary, haven't you noticed that he first goes wrong, and then corrects himself? And the dog that whines in anguish, looking for its lost master in the street, rushes into the house, worried and agitated, runs upstairs and downstairs, and from one room to another, and finally finds his beloved master and demonstrates his joy, jumping and yelping. Some brute sees this dog, which so surpasses us in loyalty and friendship, they nail him to a table and vivisect him to show us the mesenteric veins, and find in him the same organs of feelings that we have. Answer me, mechanist. Has nature endowed this animal with the wellsprings of sentiment, so that he should not feel? Has he got nerves in order to be insensitive? Because of human cruelty and callous disregard for our animal king, we are losing species every day. And we seem to be sacrificing the entire world on the altar of our greed. Present-day agricultural practices are partly responsible for this wretched state of affairs, and many of us are now going back to the garden and choosing to buy organically grown food to stem the tide of environmental destruction. However, the majority of people living in the land of the almighty dollar will not do so simply because organic food is more expensive. Now, the reason for this, according to our first guest, Mario Skipachaiko, is because government policies favor industrial production and subsidize chemical farming on a large scale. Mario Skripachaiko has published in Common Ground magazine and is the author of BC, The Organic Way, Where to Find Organic Food in British Columbia. Her website is www.bctheorganicway.com. And she lives in Nelson, I think. Thanks for joining us today, Maria.
Morning.
Hi. In the introduction of your book, you write that choosing to buy organic foods is one of the most empowering things we can do in a world which so often makes us feel politically powerless. Would you elaborate that concept for us?
Sure. Well, to me, it's food is something that we need to buy every day. And so it's a way we can really show what we believe in. And you can show that a little bit with other things, you know, the kind of clothing you choose to buy or the kind of house you choose to live in. But you don't do that on such a regular basis. And I really feel like with food, you can show people what you believe in, and you can show that you want to, that you respect the environment by buying organic food, that you believe in a healthier life for farmers and for yourself, that you don't believe in the government subsidy policies to conventional farmers, you know, all these kinds of little details. And so I think that when you go out and spend your money in a way that you believe in, you can feel really good about that.
Yes.
And you can do it every day.
Right, and we choose every time we do so, and we can do so very, very consciously too, and make a and think of ourselves as being politically empowered that way, as you say.
Mm-hmm. And as well, you can take it a step further, and you can buy locally. And that's something I really try to do, and that's the thing that makes me feel good, that I'm giving my money back to the local community, to people who are doing something that I believe in, instead of sending it to some big company across the country where I don't know the people who are running the business, and I might not believe in their sort of business practices.
Right. Now, what are governments around the world doing to ensure this cheap food, and are they accomplishing this goal, or is it making problems?
Well, I think it's, they both are accomplishing their goal, which is to ensure that, that food is cheap, as well as making problems at the same time. I think that for several decades, the government food policy has been ensuring that, that food is cheap. And I don't think that as consumers in general, you know, I'm not necessarily talking about people who are buying organic and locally all the time, but just as consumers in general, I don't think we're paying the real cost of food because of their subsidy programs. The government is mainly subsidizing the large farmers, the large-scale farmers, because they subsidize according to sales. So a lot of the small farmers don't get any of the subsidies at all, or get very, very little money.
No.
So I think they're accomplishing their goal of keeping food cheap. I mean, you see when you go to the supermarket, you can get a lot of food for $20 sometimes, but then at the same time, as certain consumers can go and get those quantities of cheap food, it is causing problems. It's causing overproduction of certain crops. It's causing farmers that are trying to do everything in the most natural way, like an organic farmer, be it a certified or not certified organic farmer, they're not able to really get a fair price for all the work that they're putting in because people aren't used to paying those prices. And you see, like maybe, let's just make something up and say a dollar for an apple. That seems crazy, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's just because we're so used to, as a society, being able to go to the grocery store and pay 20 cents for the apple.
Yeah, and that apple could come from New Zealand, for Pete's sake. How in the world could it have gotten over so cheaply?
Yeah, well, it's all through subsidies and economies of scale. It's big, huge farms and big distribution companies. And in fact, a lot of these different stages of the food chain are owned by a few large corporations that own the farms, they own the trucking companies, they own some of the grocery stores, they own some of the factories that produce the cash registers at the grocery stores, all these different levels. So they're able to produce so much involved with getting food grown and getting it to market that they can then charge lower prices.
So it's not as though they were, in fact, that organic agriculture has lower yields. In fact, I was just hearing the other day that they're very comparable if you study it for, you know, a certain duration. In the short run, it may be true that you can produce more, but not for very long.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. In the short run, sure, maybe on, you know, one field of monoculture carrots, big, huge field of carrots, maybe they can produce more. They can produce more in that first year, but over time, the soil is really going to get depleted growing carrots in the same field. They'll take away all the same nutrients year after year, and the yields eventually go down. And yeah, you're right. Studies do show that.
Now, Canadian farmers receive no subsidies, which is unlike the EU and Britain. Could you describe some of the measures that are being implemented in these countries to preserve and encourage organics, and which also saves wildlife, which is the purpose of our show, is to highlight the plight of animals in conditions around the world. So it also happens in agriculture.
Yeah, for sure. I can talk a little bit about that. Mm-hmm. I think we need to make it clear that we're talking about organic food because the Canadian government does subsidize conventional farmers.
Yes.
But no, the Canadian government isn't subsidizing organic farmers. Certain things that you'll find in European countries are, for quite a while, some of the smaller countries that aren't the huge agriculture producers like Sweden, Norway, Switzerland, there some of the governments have been funding conventional farmers' costs to become organic farmers. So they're helping educate them, they're subsidizing their costs of conversion, which could be things like, let's say they have to change all their fence posts because the older fence posts have some kind of a toxin in them. They're helping out with costs like that, mm-hmm. as well as then for the certification. They've been paying for that.
Now, but what about in Britain, for example, hedgerows?
Yeah, that's right. That's a fairly new thing that's going on over there, and they call it the Environmental Stewardship Scheme. And what's happening in mainly in England, but a little bit in Scotland as well, is that governments are funding farmers, conventional or organic, but funding them for protecting land for the benefit of the wildlife. And so, yeah, you're right, hedgerows is one. That's a spot where all kinds of birds and bugs and different insects live that can benefit the organic farmers, actually. And also for riparian areas.
What does that mean?
Wetlands.
Oh, yes.
Which would be great habitats for birds, mm-hmm. as well as for different frogs. So what this program is doing is it's maintaining the biodiversity of these areas, and it is also helping. Doing this also helps the organic farmers, because by having these kind of areas, they can have a wider range of animals living on their land that can then come into the agricultural areas and do the pest control themselves. You could have birds coming in and eating bugs, or larger insects coming in and eating smaller insects. So it's a benefit in both ways, and the government in Britain is subsidizing some of these farmers, or any of these farmers that are doing that. And it could be a conventional farmer that they subsidize if they do this on a separate area of land, but generally it ends up being the organic farmers who do benefit from this because they've just been doing this for so long. It's a part of their organic practices and their whole philosophy on life.
That sounds beautiful. Now, what are the chances of the Canadian government doing something like that? I know we're pushing GMOs all over the world destroying our own markets in the process, because, of course, many countries don't want these GMOs.
Well, I don't think the chances of the Canadian government making big changes like that are really great. I think in Europe, a reason that there are a lot of these different policies that benefit organic farmers and the environment is that Europeans are much more connected to food than we are. Now, again, that's just a generalization, but they know a lot more about growing food, about what they're eating. They're interested in that. Everybody is. As well as I think that they're a group of people that are more used to standing up for what they believe in. And so I think when you get that in a general population, you get some of those people in government. And I think that in general that doesn't happen as much in North America. So we do have great lobby groups out there, and we do have lots of great people who believe in these kinds of things, but not on such a widespread scale. And you're right, the Canadian government is really pushing for a greater number of GMO crops being grown in Canada, and it's lobby groups that are managing to stop that, and the public writing letters in. But it seems like our government right now is going more that way than pushing for organic agriculture, marketing the benefits of it. You do see some small little things happening. There's an organic initiatives program in Alberta right now where they're trying to subsidize some of the conversion costs for conventional farmers going organic, but it's a very small program.
Now, chemical agriculture isn't very old, is it? How did it, come about that people started to use this after thousands and thousands of years of development without chemical fertilizer, and we seem to have done very well? How did this come about, and is there any truth to the claims that are made on behalf of conventional, or what's now called conventional agriculture?
Well, just sort of in brief, the way it came about was this century, or this last century, now that we've turned into the 21st century, more or less around the time of World War II, when they had a lot of nuclear waste left over after World
War
II, chemical waste, and looking for different ways that they could use that. Mm-hmm. And to try to sort of soften the whole image of everything, of all the chemical waste that was left over. And they found that they could do things like create the fertilizers and the pesticides, and this could give a softer image to all of the chemical waste that was left. And, in a sense, they did find that there were benefits. They found that they could kill off a whole bunch of pests that were harming a particular plant. And I think in the short run, that they saw that as a good thing, because in a particular year when there was an epidemic of a certain bug, they were able to combat it really quickly. But they didn't look into the long term, and I guess they didn't know at that time either. I mean, some people were looking ahead and had good ideas of what of the problems this was going to cause, the problems that it was going to cause to the environment as well as it was going to cause to human health. But at that point, you know, there were a lot of people that saw it as a benefit. And I think that at that time, you know, the depression was still in people's minds, as well as both world wars. And there were a lot of people that had been going hungry during those periods. So it was easy for people to believe that this was going to be the answer. That, you know, we would be able to have better crops if we did use all of these.
And monocropping and so forth may have brought on these disastrous pest infestations that for which we needed an excuse to eradicate them. But even weeds, I mean, why is it necessary to eradicate weeds in a poisonous way, which, of course, destroys all the animals that feed off these weeds? I mean, the bees feed as much off the weeds, so-called, as the plants themselves. Isn't that so?
Mm-hmm, it is. Well, in fact, certain weeds, I mean, a weed is just something we don't want in our garden. They could be a viable plant if it wasn't right in the middle of your tomato patch, and certain plants like that are more beneficial to the bees or to certain bugs and butterflies than the ones we're growing in our garden. But I think that the reason that certain people would favor the chemical herbicides is it's just much quicker. You go out there and anybody who has a small garden knows what it's like to go out weeding and in the garden, and it takes a lot of time, and it can be a really pleasurable experience, but it does take time. And the big farms that favor conventional practices, they don't want to put that time in, and they can just quickly go over, drive a tractor through and spray this and kill off all the plants that they don't want there very quickly. And like you say, kill off other things that would benefit the environment at the same time. But for them, it's just a matter of economics, of it being faster, and they find that then being less expensive, they're not paying laborers to be walking through the fields, pulling the weeds by hand.
Mm-hmm. And I was going to ask you something about companion planting, yes. What mm-hmm. can you tell us about that? And there's another method of pest control that works very well?
Yeah, it does. Mm-hmm. Now, I am not a professional organic farmer, so I'm not a true expert on this, but the idea is that if you plant certain plants together, they benefit each other. And the benefits could be that one plant you plant will deter a particular pest that's a pest to that plant's companion, or it could be that you plant two plants together and one plant has a kind of a flower on it that will attract certain bees or butterflies that will help pollinate the other plant. Or like, for example, carrots and dill are really great planted together. You can plant your nasturtium flowers in amongst your tomatoes, and there you'll get different pollinators coming to the nasturtium plants because of the beautiful flower, and then they'll go over to the tomato plants that are right side by side. So there's a lot that can be done with that. And just by talking about that one little idea there, you can realize how much organic farmers need to know, you know, to know about all these different pairings of the different plants to be able to use these techniques instead of the sprays.
Yes. Now, you want to tell us a little bit about the book that you published and when you published it and how up-to-date it is?
Sure, yeah, sure. I can talk about that for a minute.
Okay.
Well, I did the research for it a couple of years ago. It was published 2 years ago, so I was working on the research the year before that. And what it is it's an organic food guide to British Columbia. So mainly it's a food guide divided up by region so that the general consumer, as they're traveling about British Columbia or living in different towns, can find organic food. They can find it in stores, cafes, bakeries, bed and breakfast, farmers markets, all kinds of things like that. And then as well, I've included a lot of articles about the organic industry, about the importance of it, about what makes a farm organic, about what the certification process is like, and then stories of certain farmers around British Columbia who are successful organic farmers and doing things in what I consider to be interesting ways. And I keep the book up to date because I have a companion website, I guess you could say.
Okay.
And on that website, I publish articles that I write about the industry, about what's going on right now, as well as I publish updates to the different regional chapters. So if a farmer's market has changed and it's now on a different day, you can go online and you can see that.
And that's
bcveorganicway.com. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I'm going to give away your book at
great.
End of the show to the first caller who calls in at the end of the show. It's called BC, The Organic Way, Where to Find Organic Food in British Columbia. And you also publish in Common Ground. What's your next article going to be about? Any idea yet?
Yeah, I'm going to get going on something next week, and I want to write about the wine industry in the Okanagan.
Mm-hmm.
There's only a couple wineries right now that are or doing organic wine production, and I find that to be a little bit curious, so I want to do a little more research about that, because we're finding that in the Okanagan, the farmers are making better money, or and think they will over the next few decades, planting vines instead of planting the fruit trees. So some are pulling out the fruit trees and planting the vines, and we're noticing that even a lot of the organic farmers that had an organic orchard or organic vegetable garden and are going to into wine production are beginning by doing conventional wine production because they're concerned that they're not going to be getting enough yield with organic production. So I want to explore that a little bit and see how they're going to plan to convert back to organic once they get the wineries established.
So there's this pressure coming from the fact that wine is a more lucrative product than organic farm produce, or what?
Yeah, and I think this is the yield.
That's unfortunate, isn't it?
Yeah, it is unfortunate. It is, because it doesn't, you know, it's hard to say what's going to happen down the road.
Uh-huh.
Where are we going to be getting our organic produce from here in British Columbia?
Really?
Right now, I mean, surely we can import it, but it's not as fresh. It's not supporting the local economy. It's not as good to get something that was picked green 2 months ago and ripened in a controlled warehouse than it is to just go and get your ripe apricots right now, for example. So it doesn't, you know, you can't fault the farmers for doing it, because they're needing to make a living. And organic farmers generally will say that it's you know, I can't talk for everybody, but a lot I've spoken to say it's more of a hand-to-mouth existence, organic farming.
So thanks very much for explaining these things for us, Mario.
You're afraid
we're out of time. So organics is the way of the future, and I don't think there's any future in a chemical agriculture or genetic manipulation of agriculture either.
No.
So we're going to urge our audience to reclaim their political power by choosing organics and by urging our government to go back to the garden.
Great.
Thanks a lot.
Okay, thanks for calling. Bye-bye.
Bye. Mario Skripachyko writes for Common Ground magazine on organics and biodiversity. Okay, her website is www.bctheorganicway.com. And we have her book here, BC The Organic Way, for the first person to call us after the show. And you call 604-684-7561, 684-7561, and ask for the book. Stay tuned. Animal Voices here on CFRO 102.7 FM. We're going to be talking to herbalist Robert McCandles right now. And I think we'll go without a break, since time is running short. Are you there, Robert? Hello, Robert.
Yes, hi, John.
I can't hear you. There we go.
Okay.
All right. Well, let your food be your medicine and medicine your food, said Hippocrates. And the natural forces within us are the true healers of disease. Well, we live in an era of unbridled government regulation of both our personal lives and the economy. And Dr. Ron Paul is a U.S. congressman and himself a doctor who opposes Codex. But the Food and Drug Administration bureaucrats seem to be hotter than hell to regulate supplements in the same manner as prescription drugs. Is the same thing true? Does Codex threaten the survival of alternative medicine and herbals and supplements and vitamins in Canada as well?
Well, it's sort of open to question, but I think not. Canada's regulations, we will not be adopting the guidelines, and this is their official word on it. They say they will apply only in countries that regulate vitamins and minerals as foods. In Canada, vitamin and mineral supplements are regulated as natural health products, a different thing. The proposed Codex guidelines are therefore not applicable in this country. and that's right off Health Canada's website on this issue.
So the natural health products are under the drug directorate, is that right?
It is under the drug directorate in a separate category called natural health products.
But that hasn't kept the government from threatening their existence. For example, I remember that the comfrey was taken off the market not so long ago.
Well, that's going back probably a good 8 years ago.
Oh, is it? Okay.
Yep.
And 7 years ago was when they started to when they in fact first started with the natural products directory.
Yeah,
is that right?
There was an enormous protest. The restrictions on the foods, in other words, the food supplements, were going to be very, very strict about 8 years ago. And there was a massive protest across Canada. We had 100,000 letters hit the Liberals alone. And that's why the new Minister of Health, the old one lost his seat, but Alan Rock, the new guy, brought in the Natural Health Products Division, trying to satisfy Canadians' wish for access to these products. And that whole process started about 8 years ago.
Okay, and so the WTO is not going to have the effect on these products as it will have in the USA, and what it has also had in Europe, I guess.
Well, yeah, the guidelines there... Obviously, if the European Union adopts the Codex guidelines, then the 25 countries in the European Union will be affected directly. So they have a problem there. Everybody else, they're supposed to be voluntary. Codex, theoretically, is a voluntary thing that countries can adopt. And then if you would regulate your supplements as foods, they would come under the Codex guidelines. So that is a possible worry there. Thirdly, if you have a free trade agreement, you might be in trouble if the World Trade Organization has the power to enforce the rules. In other words, if the Canadian-U.S. free trade agreement, if the World Trade Organization decided to step in and bully us into enforcing regulations, then we could have a problem possibly. But right now it looks like we have a separate category.
So that would only be possible if it were under food?
Exactly. There are some countries that have their supplements regulated as non-foods or in a separate category, and they are theoretically not subject to these regulations.
Now, there are Canadian groups that are calling for it to be put under under the food category in order to prevent any kind of fiddling with it.
Well, you see, where we had the big problems 8-10 years ago was under the Food Directorate. We had a hell of a lot of problems. They were regulating everything in sight, including comfrey, including all kinds of things. And it was draconian. There was no way to protest. There was no way to get these guys to listen. I think we're better off now that we have a system where that we've hammered out slowly over the last 6 or 7 years. I think we've got a better system now of making our needs known.
Uh-huh. Okay. Well, what's going to happen in the United States, do you think? I think that the Court of Justice that was supposed to, and the chief advocate there, had said that this was really an illegal move, but he's been overruled, isn't that right?
In Europe, that's
true.
Yes. Yeah.
So what's happening there now? A lot of products are going to be proscribed?
Well,
and are already proscribed?
It's going to hit on August 1st, so we will see very shortly what the rules actually look like. Right now, the whole Codex thing is it's a big fuzzball. It's hard to know exactly what they're talking about because everything's kind of fuzzy. Oh, we're going to regulate this and regulate that. They don't tell you what exactly. So, of course, people are worried in Britain, especially in Britain, USA, and Japan. Those are the three countries which have done the most protesting about this. And I hope they continue to do that. But knowing exactly what it's going to look like is anybody's guess right now.
Now, has Codex been ratified? It was put to be ratified this month, right?
The whole thing is a process that's been taking place over the last, I guess about the last 10 years. There's 125 countries involved. It's a big yak session that goes on and on and on. Ratification, well, they keep, adding this and adding that. It's supposed to regulate food safety, basically, in the world. And it's not just this small document that's, people sign it and it comes into action. It's a process.
Well, this is like 15,000 pages of legalese.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Oh, yeah, impossible to figure out.
And yeah. some enterprising doctors have done this, and I've got here Codex Alimentarius Threat.
Yeah.
Which is Dr. Sherry Tenpenny.
Okay.
And Dr. Rima Labo. And boy, they go into horrifying detail where you know, Ayurvedic medicine will be illegal and lots of ethnic practices will become illegal, where herbs become illegal, where you're not allowed to treat, heal, or prevent disease through
right.
these methods.
Yeah.
What do you think of that? Is that a just...
Well, this is speculation, but is there concern? Of course there's concern among consumers all over the world. Producers of Ayurvedic products in India and vitamins in Canada, we're all concerned about this. Now, the drug companies, of course, would like to rule everything. Corporate rule seems to be what globalization is all about. In fact, fascism is, the definition of fascism that I like is the corporations plus the government against the people, which is exactly what Adolf Hitler set up in Germany. He had enormous corporate backing. So the job of government is supposed to be protecting their citizens, not exploiting it. When we get our governments in bed with the corporate agendas, of course we have big problems and we have worries. So what these two doctors are talking about is a possible worst scenario, that, you know, the whole world becomes blanketed with these rules and nobody can buy anything.
Well, we've seen some of the actions of Health Canada, and they're not too population friendly. Brill Edwards and other whistleblowers have felt the wrath of Health Canada. And, you know, we've had arbitrary actions taken by Health Canada, which are really problematic.
Absolutely. Absolutely, that's true.
Yeah. Are we going to see some relenting of this? And with the who is in charge of the Natural Health Products Directorate? Is it a medical doctor? Is it a... some industry representatives? Are they from the pharmaceutical?
There's a considerable committee of people who have been involved in this, including our group, the Gaia Herbals in Vancouver.
Oh, yes.
We've been there probably about every 3 months for the last 6 years.
Really? Wow.
As part of the consultation process. And believe me, it's hammering it out. It's not easy work,
okay.
Hammering out all these details, because you have prejudices. You know, the nutritionists believe a certain thing, and the pharmacist believes something else. So it's a gradual process. But I think if you're going to be part of a democracy, you have to have some faith in your government that if you work with them, they will protect you. And that's been the whole deal. If you can't protect your government, then you might as well burn down the parliament building, shoot them all, right?
Right.
I mean, they're jerks if they're not willing to listen. I feel we've got pretty good listening happening right now, and a reasonable program set up so that people do have access to the products. You'll be able to get them. You'll have on the label what is in it. You'll have you'll be assured that what is in it is what it says on the bottle, because there's some testing going on. You'll be assured it's quality. It's not going to be 10 years old and it's dead because of the quality testing.
And people will be able to buy these off the shelf, so that we are guaranteed access to them, and we're guaranteed that you and I can heal ourselves.
Yeah.
Well, not practice medicine, but you know, just use safe products.
Even preventative medicine. It's well known that cancer can be prevented if you have the good nutrients in your diet. A good broad spectrum of nutrients in your diet is highly preventative for cancer. So these things are medicines in that sense.
Yes.
For sure.
Well, but you can make claims from dandelion root, too, the medicinal value of dandelion root. Surely they're not going to come into your garden and arrest you for growing dandelions.
No, they're never going to do that.
No, so the whole thing would lead to ridiculous proportions, wouldn't
exactly.
it? Exactly. Now, what does safety mean in terms of herbs and vitamins?
Well, there have been products on the market that have been unsafe. For example, some peptonics have had actual stimulant drugs in them. Things like ephedrine, which are alkaloids, which are highly toxic to some people, should not be taken with high blood pressure, etc. There have been contamination. There have been heavy metal contamination. You're going to find bug legs and all kinds of stuff in some herbal products that might be dangerous in some cases if you get live worms or whatever. There's got to be some kind of regulations on what is... you know, what you can put in a capsule. There was a guy in the States years ago that put tapeworm eggs in capsules and sold them as a weight loss remedy.
Oh, smart.
And it worked.
Yeah, no kidding.
But he got away with it, you know, because there wasn't any sort of regulation in place to say, no, you can't sell tapeworm eggs.
Thanks very much, Robert. I'm afraid that's all the time we have.
All right.
Now, you can be located at or contacted at Gaia Garden Herbals, where you work every day, or is that right?
Yes. Uh-huh. And there is a very good website. It's codexinfo.org. I'd recommend that people look that up. A very balanced viewpoint.
Codexinfo.org.
That's right.
Thanks very much.
You bet.
Okay, goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Robert McCandles is a master herbalist and clinical herbal therapist. He can be contacted at Gaia Gardens Herbal, which is located at 2672 West Broadway in Vancouver. The website is www.gaiagarden.com. And now we go over to Carl.
Yes, well, you're listening to Animal Voices coming to you on CFRO Radio 102.7 FM. And many of our programs are listed on our webpage, animalvoices.org. Click audio, and you can hear many of our past programs. So on the line today, we have Ashley Fruno. And she's an activist with many, with varied interests. And she's reached us today. Hello, Ashley. Are you there?
Hi there.
Good to hear from you again. And this time we're online. Often you come in here. And one of the subjects that concerns many people who love animals is the aspect of euthanasia. And I wonder if you could give us a bit of perspective about that.
Well, because of the high number of unwanted dogs and cats and the severe lack of good homes, sometimes the most humane thing a shelter worker or an animal control officer can do is to give an animal a peaceful release from a world in which companion animals are often viewed as surplus, and a lot of them are unfortunately unwanted. So the pet population is very, very, very high. It's actually one human to 45 cats and 15 dogs. So there simply isn't enough homes in this world for everyone, and that means that sometimes animals have to be euthanized in shelters.
Which, of course, people think the shelters are a place where they're sheltered, and that's not the reality because there's such incredible, I believe in the United States, some 6 to 8 million cats and dogs are handled by these organizations.
Yeah, that's correct.
And 4 million are unwanted cats and dogs. So
right. That
presents quite the problem.
Yeah, millions of animals come into North American shelters every year, and unfortunately almost half of them, are euthanized because there's not enough homes.
So often there's alternatives. When people have lost interest in their pet or they move, what happens to these?
Well, a lot of times people do take them into shelters, and a lot of times the animals are euthanized because there simply aren't enough good homes. But there are alternatives, like finding your animal a good home by putting an ad in the paper and going through friends. Certainly there's things we can do to prevent euthanasia. One of the most important things we can do is spaying and neutering, because we all know that every animal deserves a chance to thrive in a responsible and permanent home. But breeders and pet stores and people who fail to spay and neuter their companion animals have created a tremendous overpopulation problem, which forces animal shelters to euthanize a lot of animals. But if we all spayed and neutered, then every kitten and puppy and dog and cat could get a good home, because every kitten and puppy born is a virtual death sentence for an animal that's sitting in a shelter awaiting a home.
Spay and neuter is so important. And how are we moving ahead with municipalities subsidizing spay and neuter?
Yeah, there are a lot of municipalities which help out with spaying and neutering. License fees are reduced if your animal is spayed and neutered. And in a lot of municipalities, it's actually illegal. It's a bylaw that you have to have your animal spayed or neutered.
So there's a terrible aspect here of unwanted animals. And if people just abandon them, they starve or freeze or get hit by a car. I'm just going to read this here. Or they die of disease, or they may be tormented by unfriendly people.
Right.
But the worst aspect of all, as we know, is that many of these unclaimed animals go to laboratories to be used in experiments, and they're eventually killed. Well, I mean, what a fate for an animal that animals and pets that only, give kindness to the human species.
That's actually more common in the States. In Canada, pound seizure is not very common at all, and most animals that are unwanted in shelters are humanely euthanized. But in the States, you're right, that does happen a lot, where animals are seized and taken to laboratories.
Yes, I've seen that on TV. They have these dog catchers going around. And so is that more of a problem in United States, abandoned animals?
Yes. In most states, it is illegal for pound seizures to happen, but in some states, pound seizures is still legal. But in Canada, it's extremely rare.
So now, of course, there's the legitimate euthanasia where animals are sick. And I've had many people have had experience that of losing an animal. And maybe on a kinder note, we can talk about this, relief that the animals get when they're very sick.
Right. Well, euthanasia is not horrible. It's a painless process for the animal. They're given an injection, an IV injection of sodium pentobarbital, which just makes them go to sleep. And in shelters and in vet clinics where animals are sick, the animals are euthanized in the arms of someone who loves them, and they're talked to softly and given lots of treats. So the shelter workers and the vets make it as painless for the animal as possible. And some shelters in the states, in the southern states, gassing and shooting of animals is quite common, but various animal welfare groups are working to change that and introduce lethal injection.
So, Ashley, how do these no-kill shelters manage?
Well, no-kill shelters are great for animals, but sometimes the animals that aren't adopted out of no-kill shelters have to sit and wait for homes for years in cages, and that really reduces their quality of life. And although no-kill shelters do a great job, there's still always an animal shelter in the community that has to kill animals because there isn't a lack of shelters, there's a lack of good homes. So introducing more no-kill shelters, unfortunately, won't help the overpopulation problem.
Right. So before we go on to maybe I'm going to ask you some of your other activism work here. Maybe you just kind of wrap up the importance of what the work you're doing with this program,
sure.
Informing people about spay and neuter.
Yes, spaying and neutering is very important. And also, if you or anyone you know ever wants to adopt a companion animal, make sure you go to a shelter so you can give an animal that's waiting there a second chance at life. And also, if you ID your animal, if you put a tag on their collar, or if you tattoo or microchip them, that way your animal can be returned to you immediately if they ever go into a shelter, whereas if they didn't have ID, they'd have to sit and take up valuable space in a shelter that could be used for another animal.
So that's wonderful. You give us good and bad solutions. So now you've been involved in quite a number of other projects. Maybe you can give us some of the thoughts you have on what you're doing.
One of the things we're doing is we're campaigning against the eating of dogs and cats in Korea, which I'm sure you've heard a little bit of about. Every year, 2 million dogs and cats are consumed in Korea, and they're bludgeoned, electrocuted, and strangled. Also, they can be used for consumption or used as ancient medicines for rheumatism.
Now, you had a protest outside the Korean embassy on Burrard Street. Burrard Street? How was that? How did it go? What did you do?
It went really well. We had about 20 members come out and help out with the protest. We got quite a bit of media. We had BCTV and 4 Korean media outlets. We didn't get a response from the Korean consulate, unfortunately, but we didn't really expect to, so...
They're sensitive to trade issues and image as well. And if one tells people some of the inhumane things they're doing to people in North America who basically are pet lovers, it really turns against many of the products which they're wanting to promote in this continent.
Right, yes.
So anyway, thank you for the wonderful work you're doing. And we're going to talk about this, the whale, and what's been happening this past week. That was very much in the news,
mm-hmm.
And the Vancouver Humane Society. Everybody knows about Vancouver Humane Society. They Deborah Probert had an article in the paper, and she very clearly wrote, and when she said. She said, when you raise an animal, and of course, let me get the background here. In as many years, we've had about 5 whales die at the Vancouver Aquarium. Recently, last week, we had baby beluga die from apparently no known causes. But when you consider the aspect of how they live in a small bathtub instead of the ocean, it's a horrendous situation. And many people feel that there's not suitable entertainment for people to go to. And Deborah Probert, she wrote, it was published in the Vancouver Sun, she said, when you raise an animal in an alien environment that is thousands or millions times smaller than his natural environment, how can you expect him to survive? It's time that the public, including our economy-stimulating tourists, stopped paying the aquarium to abuse animals for public entertainment under thinly disguised veil of education. Shame on the aquarium, and shame on those who pay to watch animals suffer. So that's an indictment on all of those who go there and the tourist industry. And have you been to the aquarium?
Have I been?
Yeah, have you, I mean...
As a child, I went.
Right.
Not currently, but I think that it's very awful. Obviously, whales in captivity lead very different lives than they do in the wild. Their movements are restricted, and they're forced to perform on cue. It's a really, really awful life for them.
Good. Well, thank you very much, Ashley, and letting us know. Give us some information on the euthanasia and Korea. So, bye for now.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Bye.
You're listening to Animal Voices coming to you on CFRO Radio 102.7. And I was wondering if we could have just a little levity and a bit of music. Do we have a tune or two? Over to Alan Jensen. I know a switch with the switches and buttons here. Well, that was Brian McNeil, and that tune was called The Owl Waltz, with his big eyes going, doing the three-step. Well, we spoke briefly about the baby beluga dying, and that's been a succession of whales in captivity who don't manage to survive into a healthy, into a long life, and they should be living some 50 years or more. So, here we have a baby beluga dying after 3 years. So, in the so-called care of the aquarium staff and scientists. But there was a wonderful letter in Burnaby Now, and it was written by Mariana Verrigan, and she wrote, "Dear editor, baby, I find it utterly baffling how a society that cherishes our freedoms can find enjoyment in the imprisonment and oppression of others. Amusements wrapped in a package called, inverted commas, education, may serve to fool our sense of right and wrong for a short time. That is until tragedy strikes to waken us up. I hope that Tuvok's, that's the baby beluga, Tuvok's death will prompt a serious reassessment of the way in which we treat other species. It's time to truly show our respect and reverence for the lives of all species with whom we share this planet. Stop using them for our gain and let them live as free of human interference as possible. And then there was a fellow by the name of Carl Larsken. He wrote a letter, and that was also published in the Vancouver Sun. And the Vancouver Aquarium is saying the important thing is that people, that having whales in captivity is important for education. And one needs to counter that. And I wrote, educating the public about whales is important. My suggestion for educating the public about whales is to follow the lead of medical schools where lifelike simulators, videos, documentaries are replacing the use of live animals. Last week, I saw a documentary and it showed the size of the human brain and then compared it to the size of the whale brain. Well, the whale brain is much larger, proportionally larger, than the human brain, and the whale brain is also more dense and more complex in structure. I went on to write, if we are going to use live animals for education, my second suggestion is that the species with the smaller brain should be put into a cage and be taught to perform inconsequential entertainment tricks, acts which it otherwise would not do. Well, I'm so pleased to the Vancouver Sun having giving me the privilege of publishing my letter there.
Good point, Carl. And maybe we should start with the veterinarian.
With the veterinarian?
Yeah, he seems to have the smallest brain of all.
Right. Okay, so, yeah.
Anything that's...
Well, maybe you can just wrap up on the you can talk about the going organic. And one of the things that when you were talking to...
Mario.
Is that we need to stress to the governments that when we... To get them to promote organic, they're subsidizing the chemical-produced foods, but they should be subsidizing organic like they do in Europe.
Absolutely.
And the thing is this, is that they say that we need to say that if you encourage organic, it's also more labor-intensive. More people are being used. This employment is being created. And it's employment in a very useful and very productive way. People feel good about producing a product that is clean and not... And no chemicals have been used.
And sustainable and manageable. We can see what happened with the avian flu this year, or was it last year already, where these outbreaks occurred on these massive farms. But they didn't occur in the organic flocks, even though the organic flocks were blamed for it by having them spread the disease from droppings of wild birds, which is just a ridiculous scenario, when we know very well that the animals in these large-scale operations are full of antibiotics and have to be pumped full of antibiotics in order to stave off these diseases, which will inevitably break out anyway. And then what do we have? We have a situation which is grotesque to most people. Why not go back to the mom-and-pop farms, to a sane way of living and a decent way of living with smaller farms and which take care of our own people.
We encourage people to support the farmers' markets everywhere, and they're abundant, and the significant thing about them is many of these products, they're fresh on the table, ready for you to purchase, mm-hmm. and they were picked the day before, if not the morning before.
Whereas in the industrial agriculture, they may have been picked months before.
And preserved
totally
in the most...
unripe.
And preserved in refrigeration in the most scientific way.
Yeah.
But it's not the scientific way that's giving us the most healthful product.
No, by far, organic is a far more scientific
John,
way
we've
to
only
go.
Got a few minutes left.
Yeah.
I'd like you to recap a little bit about the codex. It's so complex. Say it in your own words. Up to you.
Well, as I understand it, since the natural products such as herbs, vitamins, and supplements are regulated under a natural health department or a health natural health directive under the drug directorate, they are not threatened by Codex rules because Codex only applies to them as they apply to foods, which is a regulation of food standards around the world. But if they're not to be regulated under Codex, then there doesn't seem to be any threat to the existence of these products.
So Codex, what does it mean? What does it mean?
Codex is a code or book for regulating food.
And it's regulated by the World Trade Organization, and they supersede what our governments legislate.
Yes.
And they are not voted by the public.
No.
This is, we have no say in it, and they call that democracy,
they? Totally erodes our democracy because our votes become meaningless since our laws are no longer, can be thrown out the door with these, from pressure from the World Bank and the IMF. And who needs those kind of bureaucracies which have no responsibilities to us? So I guess we better end up. I just got a note that says that I'm giving out the wrong phone number. It's better to call 684-8494 right after the show closes if you would like to have the book, The BC, The Organic Way, and it's a comprehensive guide that details the sources and suppliers of organic foods, region by region, town by town, and farms, festivals, shops, markets, bistros, and bed and breakfast, all sorts of things. Beautiful, beautiful book. And it's yours if you call in 684-8494.
The Organic Way. And let's go organic. Over to Alan Jensen. And
is that it? That's all the time we have, I guess. So Alan Jensen was at the controls today. Our website is animalvoices.org. And this show is repeated Mondays at 4 o'clock. Please tune in again next week for more.